Now, before I get going, I don't want anybody to think that I'm petty, like Beth said I would be over her 6 months longer than me. All I'll say is I got a song sung to me, and you didn't. Before I get going, I want to thank the committee for all of their hard work and inviting me and Beth down here. We've had a wonderful time, and I know how much hard work it takes to put on a convention of this size, so congratulations and thank you. Beth told y'all last night we came down here for the first time on our honeymoon, and we met Liz Bailey that weekend, who was celebrating her 40th AA birthday the same day we got married. And she picked us up and drug us around this thing and introduced us to everybody and made us sit in the front row, told everybody we were her sweet little honeymoon couple. You just don't forget things like that in AA when that happens. You really don't. My name is Chuck Hartley, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. By the grace of God and the actions and steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and a good sponsor, I've been sober since December 16th, 1988. That's what I write on my mirror and lipstick. Underneath that, I write, it's quantity, not quality. Or is that reversed? But however it is, Beth sees it every morning. I just love Alcoholics Anonymous. I probably needed to come in kindergarten, but I hadn't drank yet. The only kid I know that got suspended from kindergarten. I'm sure there's a few more, but I don't know them. See, I probably have a really nice case of ADD and I needed some Ritalin. But back in 1961, they didn't have Ritalin. They had Paddling. I tell you, I about wore that out. So I needed a sponsor, somebody that I could call up and would say, oh, for God's sakes, Chuck, eat the cookies, drink the milk, take the nap, call me later. But I didn't have a sponsor in kindergarten. So I white-knuckled it till I was 12. And by the time I was 12, it was apparent to everyone that I needed a drink. So I took one. Actually, I took several. My father was a personnel director in Cincinnati, Ohio, where I grew up. One of his perks was, if he did a nice job all year, they gave him a bottle of whiskey. The nice thing for me is my parents didn't drink. My dad had that job for several years before he met my mother, and they were married 4 years before I was born, and then I was doing that white-knuckle thing till I was 12. So, I can't tell you how many bottles of liquor there were down there, but there was a lot. And I drank them all. But the first one, I only drank one time. I, I didn't know anything about drinking because they didn't drink. So I got a bottle, the prettiest bottle I could find. It was nice and clear and had cut glass, you know. It was real pretty. But it was Seagram's Extra Dry Gin. So after that first night, I didn't drink that stuff no more. But I found a couple of my buddies, and we went out into the woods to drink that bottle. And I took a big pull off of it, and they took a big pull off of it. And by the time it got back to me, I looked at that bottle, and I looked at them two bums that I drugged to the woods. I thought, this ain't coming around again. So I drank it all straight down. And, you know, for about 15 minutes, I was the life of the party. I was dancing to music that wasn't there. I was telling jokes. You know, I told them guys what I was going to do with all the girls up to the school, and couldn't wait to start doing it. That took a while longer. And they were enjoying that part of it. Then I went into a blackout. They tell me later, my life is mostly hearsay, so this may or may not be true, but as certain people remember, I went into a blackout and I start talking about their mamas. I thought I was pretty funny, but they didn't think so. So these two guys, they beat me up, and they drug me to my parents' house and then rang the doorbell and ran off into the night like the two cowards that they were. My parents came, found their oldest son in a drunken heap on the front porch, and they drug me into the living room and just left me there. And sometime during the night, one of my younger brothers snuck downstairs and threw up on me. I don't remember. I didn't do it. And I couldn't wait to do it again, you know, because that stuff hit bottom just right. You know, and then it started working its way up warm the way you like it to. Even though that stuff was nasty, it did what it was supposed to do. It made me a part of the human race, really, for the first time in my life. I always felt like I was from a different planet or something, you know. A science fiction book that I like to read from time to time called A Stranger in a Strange Land. That's how I always felt. And until I took that first drink. When I took that first drink, it was the summer of 1968. I was in the sixth grade going into the seventh grade. And there was a whole lot of racial tension in Cincinnati. Martin Luther King had just been shot. And my high school was 7 through 12. And there was about 5,000 folks there. And there's more racial tension there than anywhere else in the city. We had armed National Guardsmen walking our hallways. And it wasn't a school, really, for a little bitty seventh grader to be mingling with angry 12th graders. So I'd grab a bottle every morning and head for the woods. And the teachers and administrators were so busy with all of the other stuff, and they didn't have computers back then. They just kind of graded you like, you know, if you were in the class and, you know, raised a little hell, you got a D. And if you, you know, sat in the class and didn't, you got a C, and so on and so forth. But if you, you know, if you were marked present in another class and not in theirs, then you got F. Well, I didn't go to any classes, so I never got marked present. I was a rising junior with straight C's before anyone found out I hadn't been in school for a long time. But nothing changed, really, between my high school drinking and my adult drinking. I drank in the woods. I like the woods. There aren't any people in the woods. I didn't like people. And so it went on like that until I turned 18. My dad gave me a job at that factory. You had to be 18 to work there. And I have found for myself anyway when I was drinking that it wasn't a good thing for me to have good luck. Because that meant I could travel first class till the dough ran out. And first class is not a way for a guy like me to go. You know, I'd get a little car, a little place to live, and start buying Jack Daniels by the half gallon. I'd be driving around drinking it because I know y'all want to meet me. So I'm driving to as many of y'all as I can. And the police pulled me over for DUI. Don't know how they figured that out, but they did. And it was an election year. It was 1974, and the judge was wanting to make a name of him for himself on the hard DUI platform. So he offered me a plea bargain. He said, you can go to prison for a year. And he meant prison. He didn't mean jail. Or he said, you can go in the Army. And I said, well, can I have a couple of days to think about it? See, because I lived in just a regular kind of blue-collar neighborhood, you know. And every kid in my neighborhood did one or two things. They either went to prison or they went in the Army. Every single kid in my neighborhood that went to prison came home. And we're still waiting on some of them to come back from Vietnam. So anyway, I talked to the old timers at the bar. They were probably 35. Didn't have no job. And they said, we think you should go in the Army. And I said, why? And they said, well, guys that drink as much as you shouldn't be in the penitentiary. And plus the Army's not that, they're not that hard on people that drink a lot. They kind of like it. And they'll pay you. So based on that information, I raised my right hand and swore to uphold the Constitution of the United States. Anywhere else but an AA meeting, I tell folks I was a fine soldier. But I was anything but a fine soldier, you know. All they did was, they weren't even sending guys to Vietnam when I enlisted, but the war was still going on because they hadn't evacuated everyone yet. But they kept telling us and putting us on red alert, you're going to go to Vietnam, you're going to get your butt shut off. Now be quiet and do those 1,000 push-ups we told you to do. And I didn't have any reason to disbelieve them, so I just did them, you know. That's pretty much my military career. They made me a cook and sent me to Germany, and I got to welcome a lot of vets back, at least partway back to the world, because they weren't going to send them crazy guys straight home to, you know, Cincinnati. They was going to let them cool off in Germany for a while and blow off some steam. And I'll tell you, I got to know a few of those guys, and they knew the best guest houses, you know, where the women were good looking and the beer was cold and served in big mugs. And they knew where the best outside issues were. I didn't know a whole much about outside issues until I joined the Army. But when I got out of the Army, I knew a whole lot about outside issues. That's all I'll say. Well, I might have one more story about outside issues. Just because it's funny. But that's all I remember. They made me a cook. I was a terrible cook. When I signed up, they said, you're smart enough to be a computer operator. We're going to send you out to Fort Ord, California to be a computer operator. And they sent me Fort Dix, New Jersey to be a cook. I said, what'd they do that for? They said, I guess no computer operators died in Vietnam. Anyway, there I went, be a cook. And I was a bad cook then, and I'm a bad cook now. But boy, could I drink. And I'd drink till 3 or 4 in the morning, and we start at work about 3 or 4 in the morning. And I'd go to the rack and lay down. They'd send somebody over to get me. And you know how that is when you've been drinking all night, and then somebody comes and gets you an hour after you started sleeping. And the fights were on. I couldn't keep a stripe to save my life. And that was my military career. I don't have any really, you know, good stories to tell you about the military. The bars in Germany look like the bars in Ohio, and they look like the bars in North Carolina. Probably look like the bars here in Atlanta. So I went back home, and my dad gave me a job at that factory. Now, in a couple of years I'd been gone, that factory had just taken off. Man, they were making money hand over fist. They were paying twice what they were paying when I went into the Army. And here I am again with more good luck. And good luck for me means I want to visit you with a half gallon. And I'm going to drive my car to get there. And I'm going to get a DUI. And then I'm going to start to run in my mouth. And I get assault on a police officer. And I'm just not a very smart drunk, you know. I open my mouth and a bunch of four-letter words fall out, and they're not work or golf or anything like that. And policemen have no problem at all addressing the problem. So they addressed where the problem was coming from, and they put me in cuffs, and nice tight cuffs, you know. That's what they do with the guys that are smart aleck, nice tight cuffs. They'd take me to jail, you know. But my dad knew good lawyers, so I hardly do any time that I should have done, you know. A weekend here and a weekend there. And that's just how it went. And I finally got fed up with that stuff, and I said, you know, I think Cincinnati's my problem. I got a hold of a couple of guys, and we went out to California. And when we got there, I was there too. And so was my alcoholism. And my dad wasn't a personnel director in California. He was a personnel director in Ohio. So I'd be there for a few weeks, and it finally seeped into my keen alcoholic brain that perhaps I was in the wrong place and need to go back home. And I'd go back home and move into my parents' house, and they'd let me wash up a little bit, and my dad would give me a job, and I'd move to the woods, and I'd go to the job for a little while, and I'd figure, you know, I probably just went to the wrong part of California. So I went to three different places in California with three different groups of guys. We took three different modes of transportation when we went. And every time we went there, there we were. So we come home. And my mother came up to me one day and she said, Chuck, I want you to do me a favor. And I love my mom to death. I stole her money and everything, but that wasn't personal, that was business. But I did love her. And she said, Chuck, you know your dad's been having a lot of problems with his heart. And I said, yes, ma'am, I do know that. And she goes, we're going to do something that your dad's always wanted to do, and we're going to move to Florida. I think that's great, Mom. You guys will enjoy the sunshine down there. And she said, oh, shut up. And I want to tell you something. I said, what? She said, make me one promise. I said, sure, Ma. She said, son, don't ever come to Florida. She's had to tell me to shut up or I'd have kept talking. So I said, I won't go to Florida, and off they went to enjoy their golden years, what little bit they had left it turned out to be. And I was driving around one day. It was a beautiful day out. You know, it wasn't muggy or threatening rain or anything like today. It was a beautiful spring day. And it didn't have to be, but it was. And I was driving around drinking. And I went into a blackout, and I ran in the back of this car and messed my car up pretty bad. I was still trying to start it when the police came. And they drug me out of there and threw me down on the front lawn. And that was before I started using four-letter words. And I wonder what had happened. Well, what had happened is I'd ran my car into the back of a Mercedes-Benz. And it was a graduation present the local police captain had bought for his daughter. They didn't appreciate me. I started getting all kinds of tickets, too, man. Let's see, that was my 9th DUI. That's not that many. Come on now. I drove every day for about 16 years, drunk as heck. That's pretty good odds, only 9. 9 out of 16 years. That ain't even one a year. So that was number 9. And then they got mad at me, you know, and they gave me a ticket for spitting on the sidewalk, and they gave me a ticket for attempting to flee the scene even though my car wouldn't start. And, they gave me a ticket for trying to damage a police officer's windshield with my head, And then the clincher, they gave me a ticket for a probation violation. Because when you got 9 DUIs, you're on probation. And when you're on probation like that, you don't have a driver's license. They've been suspended forever. And you don't have insurance. So I was in a heap of trouble, but the big one was that probation violation because it was right on top of another conviction for DUI. And when you get in Ohio anyway, you get convicted of the same offense that you're on probation for. You get to wait in jail until they call your case. And sometimes that takes up to a year. And I was sitting there one day. No bond is available, nothing. You just sit and wait. I was sitting there one day, and a guy came up and said, "Your name's on the bond board." Well, you've never seen a little fat guy run so fast in all your life. I'll tell you what. I was over to the bond board in 3 seconds, and somebody had made a mistake and put me on the bond board like it was the first DUI. Somebody come with $100, I can get on out of there. And so I called my youngest brother because all 3 of us are alcoholics. I can say that because 2 of us are sober today and the 3rd one's been here before for a long stretch. He thinks he's normal. Right now he's doing recreational crack smoking. he called my brother the other day. He was real happy. Bill said, "Why are you so happy, John?" He goes, "Man, I got my crack smoking down to a 20 piece a week." I didn't even know what he was talking about. What's a 20 piece? So Bill told me. And so I called John because me and Bill are older than he is, and my parents spent a lot of money trying to keep us out of prison. And they couldn't keep John out of prison. They didn't have enough money left to do that. And so they would give him money if he asked them for it. And I told him to ask them for 100. And they had a little extra money, and they sent him 200. And he bailed me out of jail with it and gave me the other 100 and said, "I'll see you." I said, "What do you mean, I'll see you?" See, I don't know about you guys, but when I'm in trouble, I need a plan. You know, a plan, usually a few of them, you know, plan B, C, D, and E. Yeah. So if you're new here tonight and you got a plan, grab one of us up and tell us your plan. We'd really like to hear it. We promise not to laugh to at least the fourth word. So I got to make plans, see? And I was going to make them at my brother's house. And he said, "You can't come to my house." I said, "Why not?" He said, "My wife hates you." I said, "That's fair enough. I hate your wife. That's cool." I said, "Give me a ride over to Bill's house." He said, "I was talking to Bill before I came down here." I said, "Yeah, so what?" He said, "Well, Bill said don't bring you to his house neither." And I said, "Why would Bill say such a thing?" And John said, "Because him and his wife hate you." Stranger in a strange land and unwelcome. None of my relatives wanted anything to do with me. Things disappeared from their home when I went there. And so I took that $100 and went and got some thinking material. Went and got a bottle of liquor. And my keen alcoholic mind said, "You need to get out of town, boy. So you better go get you a bus ticket." So I did. To Florida. Well, I'm a liar too. And so I got the bus ticket, and next day I'm knocking on their door, and my mom opens the door and she's like, "I knew you'd be here eventually." They even had a room for me. My dad even had a job for me. He's retired down there, but he knows people because my dad was one of those guys, you know. He was a gentleman, and people were attracted to that type of person. And he knew people that knew people down at the hospital, and he got me a job as a janitor over there. But he was heading towards the end of his life, and I was heading towards the end of my drinking. My father died in 1986, and we brought him back to Ohio to bury him. And I was my mom's oldest son, and she expected me to help her bury her lover of 35 years, and I couldn't do a thing. I was completely helpless to help her. All I could do was drink. But one of those guys that I drank with in the woods had gotten sober. And he went to my mom and said, "Anything you need, Miss Hartley, you let me know and I'll do it for you." And he did. And while I was there, he took me aside and he talked to me about his drinking. Not mine. His. If he had talked to me about my drinking, y'all would have a different speaker tonight. And I said, "Man, you need AA." I said, when I get that bad, I might join too. So off I went, you know, back to Florida. My mom got to missing her family, so we moved up to Ohio. And she moved in with her sister, and I moved into the woods. I like the woods. And, you know, I didn't need any money by this point. I'd just wait for the local 7-Eleven. Back then they had single-person shifts. And I'd just wait till nighttime, and they'd have some young girl working in there, and I'd go in, stick a couple of flat Mad Dog bottles in my back pocket and take a couple of cases of beer and throw them up on the counter and tell her to give me carton of cigarettes, and I'd piss. She was ringing it up, and I was walking out. She said, "Hold on, you got to pay for that." I said, "I can't pay for it, but I need it." I said, "You go ahead on and call the cops if you need to, but just remember, I'm only going to serve a few days because the jails are crowded, and you'll still be here, and I'll be back." And that was the kind of man that I was. And I said that to her with hair down the waist and beard down to my waist and no teeth. And well, I got smart aleck with more than the police. So I didn't have no teeth. And I couldn't read or write. My little living situation in the woods was really just an old hobo shack that even the hobos wouldn't live in anymore, with a tar paper roof and four walls, and that was it. Dirt floor. And I got tired of that one day. Got up and had a little change in my pocket, which didn't happen very often. And I said, you know, I'm thinking to myself, Hartley, you're too big a sissy to commit suicide. But you'd probably get a kick out of going to that knife and gun club about a mile up the road and getting a big old stein of draft beer and smacking some cat in the mouth with it. And you could get you some self-assisted suicide. Yeah. Because this bar, I was thinking, I mean, people got drug out of that bar, killed all the time. I don't know how they managed to keep their license to stay open. So I'm sitting on the front stoop. The bar hadn't quite opened yet. I looked across the street, and there across the street was a payphone. Don't have no more of them today. I'd have been stuck. But I was like, I wonder if that guy Greg's still sober. So I went over and called him up. He answered the phone. And I said, are you still sober in AA? He said, yeah, a little over 2 years now. I said, do you think you could help me? And he said, yeah, man, I've been waiting for you to ask me that. Where are you? And I told him. He went, oh, hell. He said, hold on, I'll come down and get you. And he came down there, seen his friend of 25 years in the shape I was in, he started to cry. I knew I was in trouble then because this guy didn't cry. So he took me to his house. And like Chuck Chamberlain used to say, he rocked me to sleep. You know, for the first time in a real long time, I could sleep with both eyes closed. Because when you sleep in the woods like I sleep in the woods, you can't close both eyes. Plus, I had a tendency to go into DTs, and I needed to get up and get a drink anyway. His wife had heard that sugar was good for alcoholics. So anything with sugar in it, she'd start filling me full of it. Orange juice, carrot syrup, sugar, ice cream bars, candy bars. 20 years later, I got diagnosed with diabetes. I called her up. I said, Edie, look what you did to me. years of running around the way I run around, drinking the amounts of liquor that I drank and doing the outside issues that I did, I couldn't read or write. And I look like that long hair bum that you think about when you think of an alcoholic. Maybe not when we think about one, but when the general public does. I was their poster child. And his children taught me how to read out of the big book. They'd go to work reading to me out of the big book. And they'd bother me every once in a while like little girls do. And I'd cuss them out. And they'd say, we don't know what all them words mean, but you better stop saying them. Or we'll stop helping you read and we'll tell our dad. He's bigger than you and he'll beat you up. So I said, okay, I'm sorry. And then I'd pass out on the couch. Well, these were girls. They were 12 and 10 when I got sober. And they were practicing doing things that little girls do when they're 12 and 10. They practicing putting on makeup. And they had a live dummy sitting there, passed out. And I swear, sometimes I'd come to and I'd look like Marilyn Manson. Sometimes I'd come to and look like Marilyn Monroe. They got pretty good at that stuff. Wasn't sure if I should buy a dress or something. I was looking good. Shaved every day now, took a shower. But that's how it all started off, you know. Greg would come home from work and see me laying on his couch, and he'd eat, wolf his dinner down real quick and look at me and go, "Go get in my car." I'd be like, "Why? Where are we going?" He'd say, "Don't worry about it. I checked your date book and there's nothing in it." He was right. I didn't have nothing going on, so I went and got in the car, and he took me to an AA meeting. I said, "What's this?" He said, "An AA meeting." "Now get out of the car. We're going upstairs." And he'd take me up to the beginner's meeting. And a guy stood up and thanked everybody for 2 years, and I stood up behind him and said he was a daggone liar. Nobody can stay sober for that long. And that guy's still sober today. I see him every once in a while. He's still sober today. And the guy that took the two-year coin, unfortunately, my sponsor thinks he's normal now. Yeah, he can afford to charge his beer. And I miss him, too. If he called me on this podium, I'd cut my talk short and go home, take him to the VA. But he's not going to. He's not. But he taught me a lot in early sobriety. He really did. He took me to those meetings. And this is for you sponsors. When you're taking a new person to a meeting, don't let them slip off on you. See, because Greg would take me to the beginner's meeting and sit with me to make sure that I stayed awake for the whole thing. And he got to carrying on with his friends one night. We were in this church where there was about three different meetings going on at the same time. And I was tired of that beginner's meeting. I'd been about three times. So I slid on over to the discussion meeting. I raised my hand and started to share my 3 days of experience, strength, and hope. And some old-timer stood up. He looked like Bill. I thought I was going to have to make amends to him tonight. And he said, "Boy," that was his first problem. He said, "You need to shut up and sit down." And I said, with all my 3 days, I said, "Old man, you need to go out the window." We was on the second floor of a big church. And I said, "I'm going to toss you out that window there and see how many times you bounce before you hit the middle of Beachmont Avenue." And I went over there to do just that, and you guys gang tackled me. Wouldn't let me anywhere near the old timer. I'm sitting down there using all my four-letter words, non-name work or golf. I'm cussing and thrashing and carrying on. I'm trying to bite people, but I don't have teeth. It was a mess. The whole time I'm on the ground, the old timer's cackling, going, "Keep coming back, son. Just keep coming back." And I tell you, once I got to thinking straight again, I got to thinking, you know, when you go to the bars you drink in, you show your butt like that and they kick you out, it's for good. Here you are showing off in front of one of the older members of AA. And he tells you, you can come back. And that might not have meant much to a lot of people, but it meant a lot to me. I lived in the woods. And I didn't interact with society much. I got asked to leave most places I went to. So I kept coming back. Greg says, we need to do something about these first three steps here so that you can start writing your fourth step and get rid of the garbage. He said, let's see. Yep, you're powerless over alcohol. You don't know where you're going to wake up when you start drinking. He said, yep, your life's unmanageable. You're sleeping on my couch. He said, you better hope there's a power greater than yourself that'll restore you to sanity. You're the craziest SOB I've ever met in my whole life. He said, now get on your knees. I said, now hold on a minute. I'd join the army so I wouldn't have to do that stuff. I'm not going to start now. He said, no, dummy, I'm not talking about that. We're going to pray. I start thinking, dang, I wish you meant the other thing. Me and God had a problem, you know. I believed in him, but I thought he was mad at me because of the life that I had. I wasn't gonna take any of that blame on. That was all God's fault, that life I'd had. So I didn't regularly check in with him because I wasn't going to give him a target to shoot at, see? But he got me down there and we said that prayer. And it was special. You know, it just felt right. Felt like I belonged in Alcoholics Anonymous then. He took me to meetings every day. I didn't miss a meeting for the first 2.5 years I was sober. I didn't know you were allowed to miss. Greg took me every night, so I went every night. I never heard nothing about 90 meetings in 90 days. I don't think it's in the big book, neither. I hear stuff about, you know, we go to meetings so we can fellowship with one another. Kind of on the side, it gets interpreted as we go to meetings so we can snag us up a newcomer or two and have a reason to stay out late and not come home to the wife. And he got me to write that inventory. I needed his help and his daughter's help. And we got through that thing. And I tell you, he had me pegged. He looked at it, and it was a good size inventory. I told him almost everything. And he looked me dead in the eye, and he said, tell me the three things you've left off of this list. And he had me. That's how many there were. There was three things that I'd rather carry to my grave than tell him about. And I told him about them. I told him about that other mess too. And he just took me through the steps quietly like that. Set an example for me in 6 and 7. He said, you can see in the big book there's not a lot to read about there. And you're too stupid to read the 12 and 12. Now remember, we'd been friends for a long time. I don't think a sponsor that I'd known a week and a half would have said that to me. But Greg knew how to tell me that. And he said, so you just watch feet. You just watch what people around me are doing, because I hang out with folks that like to stay sober. And that's how I learned about 6 and 7. The sponsor that I have today says 6 and 7 are about growing up and becoming citizens of the city and county and state and country in which you live. We vote when we're supposed to vote. That we don't steal from the cashier when she hands us too much change, even if it's a 20. And I had no education. I had no skills. I had no training. And I didn't know what I was going to do for a living. Well, his wife got me a job at the Hardee's. And I was working there, and he said, "I got to work too much. I can't spend as much time with you as I used to. I'm going to turn you over to the young people because they're probably the only ones that will listen to that BS you spout." So he turned me over to the young people, and I started whining just like Palmer did about not even having a GED. And I whined to the young people. I whined to my mother. My mother said, "You've got GED, honey." And she went to her robe. See, my mom knew that her three sons were thieves, and not good thieves, so we'd steal from her. I forgot to tell y'all that me and my mother moved back in together while I was still new. And it was something she wanted to do. And but she lived in a robe that went all the way to the floor and had pockets all the way down, all the way to the floor. And anything that she thought was valuable went in the robe. Money, credit cards, real jewelry, fake jewelry, old recipes, expired coupons, couple books of S&H stamps. It was down near the bottom, you know, when the pockets first started going in. And she finally found it. She pulled this piece of paper out, and it had my name on it, and it said I had a GED. I'd passed the GED test. Now, my keen alcoholic mind couldn't figure this out until what, honey? I was about 17 years sober. Finally, when I was 17 years sober, I remember I'd given my youngest brother my draft card because I didn't need it. They were going to give me a different kind of ID. And I didn't want him to have trouble getting served on a fake ID that I had trouble getting served with on a fake ID. So I just gave him mine. And you know, we all look alike, all three of us. And so he went to take the GED. And when he got down there, he forgot that he didn't have any ID that said John. All his said Chuck. So the test was already paid for, so he said, "What the heck?" And he went in and took and passed it. So I'm pretty smart now, you know. Just graduated from high school. I start whining more to the kids in AA, the 16 to 22-year-old crowd. And I want to thank you guys for the kindness that you showed me. See, young people don't care what kind of mess you are. You can be the hottest mess going. Young people do not care. They are not taking your inventory. They're too busy thinking about them. But they will help you. And I'm whining to my buddy Jeff, who's going to college. And I said, "Man, Jeff, just like you said, I wish I could go to school, but you know how old I'd be in 4 years? Just like Palmer's." He said, "No, how old will you be if you don't go to college?" Well, I'd just graduated high school, so I did the math. I said, "I'll be doggone. It's the same answer." I really was kind of shocked. So he said, "Let's go downtown to the vocational rehabilitation people. They like to send losers like you to college." So down we went, and I got an interview, and the lady pretty much said the same thing. "We like to send losers like you to college." She said, "Now, remember, you're a guy that lived in the woods most of his adult life is talking to you here." She said, The tests say you'd make a fine social worker. I said, lady, me and people don't mix. She said, I don't care. Tests say you make a fine social worker. I said, ma'am, I'm sitting in your office with two pistols and a knife. See, I was still new, so I was still scared. And she said, I don't give a darn what you brought into my office. She said, the paperwork says you make a fine social worker. Now, do you want to be a social worker or do you want to get the hell out of my office? And she was a little sweet old lady. just as sweet as could be. She bowed right up when I tried to bowl her over, though. So I went to school to be a social worker, sitting all the way in the back of the class, telling those young kids that came in there, be, you know, them 18, 19-year-olds that come in there, get away from me. Go sit over there. And I got through the first year like that, and the second year they got a little bit ahead of me. And so I start talking to a few more people, maybe join one of them study groups they had. And I did that, and I got through the bachelor's in social work in 4 years, just like you're supposed to. And we're at the graduation. We're at the graduation ceremony, and the dean of the school of social work is going around shaking everyone's hand, going, tell me you're going to come to grad school. We'd really like to have you. And the person says, oh, yeah, Dean, I'm going to come, you know. And other people that he knew shouldn't be coming back to grad school, he'd shake their hand and say, you did a fine job here. I hope we can place you in a job that you'll enjoy, you know, and like that. And he got to me, and he shook my hand, and he said, Chuck, I really hope that you'll consider going to grad school. He said, you've done a fine job here. Because by the time end of 4 years, I mean, you just can't hide who you are. It comes out, you know, especially in classes like I had to take. And he said, please tell me you're going to go to grad school. We need folks like you with graduate degrees. And I said, Dean, I can't afford to go to graduate school. And I couldn't, because somewhere along the line I'd met Beth, and we'd come to Atlanta and party, and we'd gone back home. She moved into a little house and then moved over another neighborhood, and her kids came back to live with us, and all that was happening while I was going to school. And I said, I just can't afford it. And I told him why, and he said, could you afford to go to grad school if I paid for it? Well, my two favorite words are don't cuss words either. They're not work and golf either, but they're free and more. And he was offering me both right there. So I said, yes, sir, I'd love to go to graduate school. And 2 years later, I had a graduate degree, a master's degree in social work administration. Because thank you. Mostly because God is good, but also because I like to be in charge. So I took the administrative task. And I had a fine career as a social worker. I had a lot of different jobs, ran a lot of different programs, and enjoyed each and every one of them. And my health went south real quick the end of December last year, and I can't work anymore. It really kind of hurts to be standing up here, but what the heck. I get to go in there and sit down in a little bit and shake hands with all y'all, I hope. So I finished that, and we weren't wasn't a even 2 years, Beth got that job offer that moved us to North Carolina. And just like she said last night, we met and we danced around each other a little bit. Then we decided we liked each other and we started going on some dates. And the amazing thing about dating Beth was that in the 2 years that I courted her before we dated and got married, we managed to keep our clothes on. And that's a pretty big deal. Was for me anyway. I never asked her about it. I didn't want to start something I couldn't finish. And my sponsors had to show me how to date, you know, because I didn't know how to date. I lived in the woods, you know, or drank in some of the worst places in town where, you know, if you bought a girl a drink, you were on a date. If you bought her two drinks, you'd go outside on your date. And that's just the kind of places that I drank, you know. Sure, not all bars are like that, and I know all women aren't, but that's places I drank at. Hi, Susie. I don't know what to tell you all about my retirement. It was forced on me. I would say I like sleeping late, but we got a puppy that gets up 5 a.m. I would say I like to go to bed early, and I do. I like to go to bed about 8:30, so I'm really surprised I haven't fallen asleep up here. But most nights I don't, because I sponsor a lot of men and they like to call in the evening, and I don't like to do not take phone calls. Because when the caller ID comes up, it doesn't say this is an emergency or this is something simple. So you got to take the call. Alcoholics Anonymous is just giving me everything. Like Beth said last night, that we have two fine daughters. Or a daughter and a son. What am I thinking? I know what I'm thinking. I'm thinking my daughter's giving me a granddaughter that I just love to death. And our daughter served our country for 10 years, and she's done so proudly and honorably. Our son served our country honorably for 4 years, and they sent him home with the worst case of PTSD I've ever seen, myself included. They put that boy in the infantry and had him out on kill teams. It would just make you shudder. It makes me shudder to think about the things that he's gone through and the nightmares he has. I have some bad ones myself, but nothing like Rob had to go through. But they're both good kids. They moved from Ohio to North Carolina to be near their parents. Something I never thought they'd do, you know. And I know some of you guys in here got a different opinion than mine, but I've got the best wife in the world. And an astronaut and a fighter pilot named Chuck Yeager used to like to make a little commercial for Delco batteries. And he'd say, I've been shot up, shot down. And I said, heck yeah, Chuck, me too. Thank you for my life, everyone.